Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue Wednesday, April 3rd. We're going to take the agenda in a slightly different order. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2684. I'm opening this work session for the purpose of getting a very, very brief update on the status of working on this bill. And the intent is for us to, at the end of this brief update, we'll close the work session and come back to this on another date. LRO, do you have anything you would like to update us on? And if not, we will go to Representative Smith Warner.
I think I'll let you go to Representative Smith Warner.
Good choice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colleagues, I have continued to have a series of conversations with Frontier Communications, with some of the fellow members on this committee, about how to best resolve and move forward on this bill. And I think we're making progress, and I hope to have more information to report to you shortly.
Thank you. Representative Marsh, do you have anything to add?
No.
Thank you. That's all the information we need for today. We'll hear about this again. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2684. Now back to the printed order of the agenda. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2127.
It's a mic roll. Dang it. I have to rewrite them all.
And I am opening a public hearing on House Bill 2136 and House Bill 2664 also.
Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bills 2127, 2136, and 2664 do have some overlap. So I do have a chart that's up in the meeting materials just under, not the individual bills, but under the meeting itself that does, and it is up there on the screen, that lists what these bills are doing and how they overlap with each other. So I'll try to take them in order of the actual description of what's the content of the bill and then hit on what's in what bill. So the first one that's in House Bill 2127 and House Bill 2664 would be a six-year extension of a tax credit for manufactured dwelling park sales, and this is the capital gain subtraction. So this is in the case where, under specified circumstances, a manufactured dwelling park is sold either to the dwelling park residences or a nonprofit, and then the seller of the manufactured dwelling park can then subtract their capital gains income on their Oregon tax return. So it's kind of an incentive set up to encourage the sale of that manufactured park to either the residents or a nonprofit owner of that park. And that's in, again, House Bill 2127 and 2664. The next description, this is in House Bill 2136 and 2664, is a six-year extension of an existing income tax credit for manufactured park closure. So this is a $5,000 income tax credit that's available to the owner of the manufactured dwelling at a time when the manufactured dwelling park closes. The owner of the manufactured dwelling can receive a $5,000 refundable credit to help offset the costs of having to relocate, possibly move that manufactured dwelling, or they don't necessarily have to move the dwelling, but they just would have to find other housing in that case. There is a technical fix related to the interaction with eminent domain. That technical fix language is only contained in House Bill 2136. What the technical fix is this is really in part of the review that LRO does, as this is one of the standard credits up for review this year, is we notice some language pointing to, in cases of eminent domain, how the credit would interact with that. The idea being it is really a technical fix because it is aligning statute with the policy contained in the credit and the administration of the credit in past years. So if this committee is interested in extending that tax credit, we would recommend including that eminent domain fix in whether it is House Bill 2136 or 2664. So you'd want to add that language as part of that. And then the last tax change here is in House Bill 2127 only, And this is a six-year extension. It's an income tax or a corporate income tax exemption for out-of-state emergency services providers. And the idea here is, in the case of, there's, say, a catastrophic emergency here in Oregon, such as a large earthquake or something to that effect, out-of-state individuals or companies that come in to work on more or less rebuilding that infrastructure, Oregon's infrastructure, and that's the sole reason they're here, those companies or individuals wouldn't become subject to Oregon personal or corporate income tax laws. So to really try to set that up in that case of an emergency to get those out-of-state companies and individuals in here and working on rebuilding that infrastructure as quickly as possible. So again, those are the those are the changes contained in the different bills. Again, as just a note on the materials that you have in OLIS, the six-year extension of the manufactured part closure credit, that $5,000 credit, that was part of the review process. So it is contained in our tax LRO's tax credit review report. That information is up under House Bill 2136 and 2664 in the meeting materials for your review, for the information on what's the underlying policy behind it, the use, and some other information that could be helpful in the committee's deliberations.
Thank you. And thank you for preparing that table. Because I've opened a public hearing on the three bills simultaneously, I think it's fine for those persons who've signed up to testify. There are only a few to speak to any and all of them when you come up, instead of coming up and going back and coming up again. Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I have a question for Kyle. I'm sort of interested in the fact that HB 2127 addresses two disparate topics. So as I see it, the exemption for state emergency service providers has really nothing to do with manufactured housing. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say, yeah.
So how did those disparate things wind up in one bill?
Yeah, Representative Marsh, this is a committee bill. Okay. And so in this case, one of the things we did in the interim is to set up placeholders for expiring tax expenditures and to have those with usually it's going to be a standard six-year extension of that sunset. Mm-hmm. And it really sets in place that review process. So this is one it did. why we captured into one bill rather than two separate bills, I couldn't speak to specifically, but the relating to clause is related to tax expenditures for that reason. So it does give a potential vehicle that you could put all these changes in front of the committee within this bill certainly as well, or take them each in their individual bill.
Thank you.
John Powell, please.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing AT&T and Portland General Electric. In regards to, I guess it is the bottom X on House Bill 2127. And the purpose of my testimony is just to provide you with some background on this issue. The Oregon legislature enacted the law for that exempted certain taxes, registration and licensing requirements on individuals and companies in the event of a catastrophic disaster in 2015. Representative Lively spent a lot of time working on the issue, and it's very narrow. It's critical infrastructure companies only, which I think is pretty much communications and utilities. And the reason for the legislature taking up the issue was it came out of the NCSL as a model act. I think about 30 states have adopted it since 2012. And the idea is that hopefully eventually all states adopt it so that in these catastrophic events, employees and equipment can just move state to state very quickly just for the purposes of responding to a disaster. And the idea is that it shouldn't necessarily cost a state revenue versus another state, because it can work both ways. So if an Oregon employee or company goes to another state to assist in a disaster and that state has a law similar to this, then that company and that individual would still continue to pay their income taxes in Oregon, and vice versa. If a person or a company comes into Oregon from another state, they would continue to pay whatever they pay in their home state for this disaster period. The issue came to the attention of AT&T, not for anything having to do with their individual company, but for their employees in a disaster response to Superstorm Sandy, which I believe was in New Jersey. AT&T has a disaster teams where employees volunteer. Now, there's salaried employees, but they volunteer when there is a disaster to go immediately and stay as long as needed. So these teams went to New Jersey, worked there for a month or 6 weeks, went back home, back to their regular job. Come tax time, the employees were had to file, hire an accountant and file taxes in two states. So that was kind of the problem that we were looking to solve. The bill, House Bill 2127, would put a six-year sunset on this, which, you know, is fine. I'm not here to die on the sword over it, but I would point out that this isn't really a normal exemption that is being claimed, you know, year after year. In fact, I'm not aware of it ever being claimed yet. Hopefully it never has to be. Our fear would be that the legislative kind of history and advocacy behind it in 6 years is no longer here, and people are like, what is this? Nobody uses it, let's get rid of it, and then a disaster strikes. So I guess our preference would be that there is no sunset on it, but we'll respect the choice of the committee. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Roeschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Powell. Just a couple questions. You said it was a model from the NCSL. 30 states have enacted, or roughly. Do you know whether some of those states are California, Idaho, and Washington, our neighboring states?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Roeschke, I do not know, but I can send you the website as soon as I get back to my computer that lists them.
Okay.
Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Van Lanningham.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Marsh, members of the committee. My name is John Van Lanningham from the Oregon Law Center, and I'm here to testify on all three of these bills that relate to manufactured home park tenancies. They cover two different tax expenditures. Kyle went through them. The first is the capital gains exemption for sales when a landlord sells the park to either the residents who form a cooperative, a nonprofit such as St. Vincent de Paul, or a housing authority. The second property tax expenditure here is the $5,000 tax credit to residents of a park who are displaced by a closure. And Kyle caught needed correction to that language. It's my mistake since I wrote it in 2007. So I'm very appreciative of him catching that part and clarifying it. Both of these things arise out of the great fears of park residents. And you've heard a lot about parks over the years and park residents, people who own their manufactured home, rent a space in a park. Those three great fears are closure, because they're going to lose their home, they're going to be displaced, rent increases, or bad management. And over the years, we've done a lot of things to try to address those three things. There's some limitation. You can't prohibit a closure. You can't prohibit rent increases. But our strategy has been to encourage purchase by the residents or by a nonprofit, such as St. Vincent de Paul. And we've done a bunch of things to do that, to do those things. Both of these things relate to those issues. With regard to the property, the capital gains exemption, typically these sales arise when an out-of-state purchaser offers to pay cash for a park. It may well be a cold call in which the park owner didn't even intend to sell, but is offered a lot of money. And the development strategy of the offerer is that the park can be redeveloped as higher-end housing. There's not much infrastructure in a manufactured home park. So it makes financial sense to close the park and redevelop it. The tenants want to compete, either to have a nonprofit buy it or the residents buy it to maintain it as a park. The capital gains exemption is a very important tool to do that. There are a couple of pieces of testimony in OLIS from Peter Hanley, the executive director of CASA. That's one of the things that CASA does. CASA will send in an organizer into a park, meet with the residents, evaluate the economics of the park. One of the things that you've done over the years is to require a park owner to allow the tenants to compete. It's not a right of first refusal. It's simply an opportunity to compete, but has to share the financial data with the tenants. CASA goes in, gets that financial data, evaluates whether it makes sense for the residents to compete to buy a park. There's a park in Glenwood right now between Springfield and Eugene in which that dynamic is going on. The owner thinks it's worth more than the CASA thinks the tenants can afford to pay. So it probably won't happen that it will be preserved as a park. But the capital gains exemption is a tool that enables the tenants to compete, because what they're competing with is cash right now. And putting together the package to buy a park involves subsidies from Housing Community Services, a bank like NOAA, local government, a bunch of things. And that takes months to put the deal together. One of the documents in OLIS from CASA is a list of all the parks that they've helped residents purchase, 14, since started doing it in 2008. And also give an example of a recent one in, I think, in Clatskanie, where that happened. And I know the park owner there, and very much the capital gains exemption was very significant in his decision to sell the park to the residents as opposed to another buyer. The capital gains exemption doesn't work if the owner of the park is from out of state, because that person is not paying Oregon taxes. And we haven't been able to figure a way to make this transferable that doesn't get captured in that other state. So that's the capital gains exemption. The $5,000 tax credit is part of two things we did in the coalition in 2007 to try to assist residents who are going to lose their homes in a closure. This is one, the tax credit. It's a refundable tax credit. The second is that we require the landlord to make a payment to the tenants when the landlord closes the park. In 2007, it was $5,000 for a single wide, $7,000 for a double, $9,000 for a triple. Last session, 2017, you all increased that by $1,000, and it's now indexed. But so you combine those payments with the $5,000 tax credit, and you get somewhere 11, 13, and 15 that goes to a tenant. Many manufactured homes are worth in that range. Many are not. Many are worth much more than that. There are parks in this state where the manufactured homes are worth more than $100,000. They're probably going to lose that entire investment with a closure. So both of these are really important. It's not much of a fiscal impact to the state. We haven't had many closures since the Great Recession. We had a whole bunch of closures right before the Great Recession because there was a lot of cash looking for investment. We're fearful of it coming back with the economy recovering. Seeing a couple of closures, but not very many. The other thing I want to mention is that one of these bills, and I'm going to forget which one, includes a sunset. It's on the tax credit. The $5,000 tax credit. One of the three bills, 2127 is the capital gains exemption, 2136 is the $5,000 tax credit, 2664 is both.
One of them
includes Kyle's correction of my error. A different one includes another sunset that's related to the $5,000 tax credit. They need to be all in one package. And I assume that LRO staff will eventually put them all in one package and get that right. Happy to answer questions.
Any questions? Representative Bush?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Van Landingham, thank you for bringing these or testifying for them. I'm just kind of curious, you know, we talk about affordable housing, and this seems like one of the ways to achieve that goal of affordable housing. What is the state of just the industry in general of mobile home parks? Are we continuing to shrink the number in the state? Is there any expansion? If not, why is there not any expansion? Is there just no money to be made in it? Or can you just give me a kind of a background to that?
So, Chair Nathanson, Representative Oreschke, there are a lot of things to say about that. Mm-hmm. I think I said a minute ago there, we're not seeing closures right now. Mm-hmm. Parks are a great source of revenue for their owners. If you Google this, there's something called Manufactured Home University, in which a person teaches investors what a great deal it is to own a manufactured home park, because this is a captive audience. Once you get them in, they don't leave. They can't leave. Mm-hmm. Mobile homes are not mobile. And once they're in the park, they're subject to your, they're going to stay there. And so you can raise the rent. And they do. So they're great investments. And most of the buyers who are competing to buy these parks are buying them to hold them as an investment. They're not buying them to convert them. That's why we're not seeing many closures right now. Are there new ones? No. We haven't seen a new park in a decade, at least. There have been some efforts. You have a bill this session from, started with Representative Lively from Springfield. It's now Senator Beyer from Springfield, trying to change a housing community services program to allow the funding in that program to be used to develop a new park in Springfield. The background there is that Springfield took over Glenwood from Eugene 15 years ago when I was on the Planning Commission and objecting. But Springfield saw the future of Glenwood, has invested a bunch of money in Glenwood. Glenwood is between the two cities. It used to flood all the time from the from the Willamette. And it doesn't flood anymore. It's all on septic. And it's full of old, what are truly could be called trailer parks. They're going to all close, because the cost of installing those sewers is going to be imposed on the property owners, and they're going to need to get more cash than they're getting from their old trailer parks. We already have one closing now, or for sale right now. Springfield feels a little bad about that as a local government, and they're trying to develop a new park so that some of those residents could, they won't be able to move their homes. Their homes would not withstand the move to anywhere. But they could buy a new manufactured home there. St. Vincent de Paul is the proposed developer of this new park. Why aren't there more new parks developed, given that they are a good financial investment? I think the answer you'll hear from property developers is that the cost of land and infrastructure is so great that it doesn't pencil. And if you're going to develop it, you want to develop it with higher-end housing rather than moderate income housing. But nationally, manufactured home parks are viewed as the largest privately provided source of affordable housing in the country. And Representative Marsh has a lot of them in her district, and she's become an expert.
Any other questions?
I could obviously talk longer about this stuff.
Thank you. Listen, is there any other anything else you'd like to tell us about these three bills and any work that would need to be done, as Mr. Van Lanningham suggested, if the committee is interested in moving forward with one or the other, some of these concepts, we would need to probably adjust one bill or another to address all the issues that need to be addressed. Do you have anything else to add to that?
Madam Chair, I think it's been identified the eminent domain fix is the one technical fix that has been brought up so far, so just including that. In terms of the bills that you have in front of you, House Bill 2127, as it does have that out-of-state emergency service providers, the relating to clause in that case is broad enough to put all three of these bills and the contents in them within that one bill. Otherwise, 2136 or 2664 would probably work for the manufactured park policies on the capital gains or the credit, and then the out-of-state service providers wouldn't fit within 2136 or 2664. So it could stand alone if that was the choice of the committee. So there are options on how to move forward with that.
Okay. Committee, anything else for discussion before I close this public hearing? I'm closing the public hearing on all three bills. There's no other work before us. We're adjourned.